Welcome to our podcast. My name is Alex Held.
And I'm Chavalis Nieves.
And in our podcast, we'll be discussing a book over a three-part series. And the book is titled How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. So throughout the book, the author, Daryl Huff, talks a lot about different ways you can lie with statistics, primarily through chapters 1 through 3. He gives a bunch of different examples, like the average salary of a Yale graduate in the 30s to bias in elections in the 50s. So I want to kind of ask you, what was the most, what do you think was the most intriguing part of the first three chapters?
I thought that the most intriguing part of the three chapters may have been the part where they were talking about Yale alumni and how much they earn a year.
Yeah.
Because you're going to such a prestigious school, you would expect everyone to get so much money. But then they're talking about just a percentage of the students. They don't mention the other students that don't report their incomes. So I wonder what happened to those students who didn't report their incomes. And I wonder if they're making a good living and they didn't want to report it, or what's the deal with
and
that?
And who even knows if the people who did report them their income are being truthful about how much they make?
They're probably not, because I also, like, in the book, they were also talking about how people lie about their incomes and how much they have to pay. And I feel like everyone does that for pride, because you'll know how much money you're making and you know you'd like to be better. So if you're seeing another alumni who is making more money than you, you would want to be better than them since you guys went to the same school.
Yeah, and that average was about $25,000 a year, which back then was
a lot of money.
So,
so you mentioned the bias in elections in the '50s.
Yeah, so they talked about the presidential elections in 1948 and 1952, and they kind of related this to giving, like, a second look to things that you read, you know, every day. And it was sort of like allowing yourself to have some degree of skepticism when you read things. So what the author sort of targeted here was these two elections. And there was 10 million Telephone and Literary Digest, which was a magazine. There's subscribers who assured that the editors of the magazine it would be a massive victory for the man running against Roosevelt, Landon, who was running against FDR in 1932. And it basically said that the people who telephoned this in, the subscribers of this magazine, were not like a mixed bag of voters, and they massively favored the person opposing Roosevelt in this election. So it was kind of like saying with the same thing with the Yale graduates, they were able to just have X amount of people who actually, you know, recorded their name, reported their annual income. Who knows if they were even telling the truth? So it's like the same thing with that. These people, all of them, you know, favored the other presidential candidate, Landon, over Roosevelt, and they only chose them to be in the study, as opposed to, like, voters who were going to choose Roosevelt.
So, something that I really found interesting while I was reading this book was that they were saying that the statistics that they're going to use are from people that have more money or more educated, have more conventional behavior, and then they also have more settled habits than the average other person. So
yeah.
I feel like these statistics are extremely biased, because if you're looking at the average amount of people and their incomes, you're going to think, okay, well, their ideas are completely different than the ones that we have or we want. But then looking at, like, the more educated people, people with the more money, with better conventional behavior habits and things like that, their votes are going to be completely different than the ones of the average person, because they're going to do stuff that are more beneficial to them. They're not going to think of the person who makes the average salary. So I thought that really interesting.
Sort of like a transition in the next chapter, which is called The Well-Chosen Average. There was this this house that was for sale in, this is just a theoretical example, a house for sale that the author was selling to another person in a neighborhood called the California Valley. And he said that the average income of the neighborhood is $15,000 a year. And as we find out, as we keep reading, that figure is the mean average, or the arithmetic average. So it's all the incomes in the neighborhood added up and then divided by the total number. What the author was trying to say is that's a very deceiving number.
It is.
$15,000 does not tell you much about the neighborhood. You may think, well, you know, that's a pretty wealthy neighborhood, but when you look at the median average and it tells you how many of the families in question have more than $3,500 in this neighborhood, it's a lot lower. And you could also use the modal average and found out that there are a lot more families that earn $5,000 a year than anybody else.
Yeah, I thought that interesting too, because if you're going to start selling a house and then you're going to, you know, try to sell it for, you know, a person who's earning $15,000 a year. Mind you, this is in the 1930s, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like you need to have a different type of statistic because you're doing it to benefit them. Everything goes back to somebody making a profit out of whatever they're selling, whatever they're making, or whatever, you know, they need. And they need to, they're lying with statistics.
Yeah,
because,
and I think the most interesting part about that, not to cut you off, but is that they use these statistics that are true, but they deceive you in the way they represent them.
Right.
And again, with the family thing, with the income of the families in that neighborhood, there $15,000 might have been the average because there were a couple people who were earning a lot more than that, but a lot of people were earning like a lot lower. In this, another example that the author used to shows how averages, you know, don't really tell the truth, was this company where the average wage of the employee is $2,000 a year, and the average salary and profit of the owners was about $26,000. He chose to show it through this little graph that showed the mean, or the median average and the modal average. And what's really interesting about this is that at the top you had somebody earning $45,000 a year. That was one person. And then right below them was somebody earning $15,000. And then two people earned $10,000. And then we hit the mean average, which was $5,700. So there are five individuals above that average, and there are a whole lot more below that. And as we see, we have three people earning $5,000, and then there's four people earning $3,700, and then we hit the median average, which is there are 12 people above him and 12 people below him, and the median was $3,000. And then right below that was the mode, which was 12 people earning $2,000. So the modal average is obviously not something that the owner would want to show, nor would the median. So they would likely show the mean average, which is $5,700.
And just looking at this, it's so unfair because I actually think it's deceiving, knowing that there's a company advertising $5,700, when in reality most of the people are making $2,000.
Yeah, like they're saying, like, this is what you can be making if you come work with us, but in reality you are far more likely to earn $2,000.
Right. For checkpoint number two, we decided to start off with a quote. There are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics.
I think what's interesting, Chevalise, is that you already see that portrayed in the introduction. And the author uses an example of his father-in-law making a conclusion about an article that was in a local newspaper about crime. And the author says that his conclusion was statistical in an informal way. quote, "It was based on sample, a remarkably biased one. Like many a more sophisticated statistic, it was guilty of semi-attachment. It assumed that newspaper space given to crime reporting is a measure of crime rate," unquote. So what he was really saying here was that you can't just look at something like an article that cites a percentage for, let's say, crime rate in this example, and use that as a way to justify your reasoning or your answer, because you really don't know what's all behind that statistic. Would you like to add anything?
In addition, in the introduction, they also talk about the averages in relationships and trends in graphs are not always what they seem. There may be more in them than meets the eye, and there may be a good deal less. And the introduction is really relative to chapters 3 to 7, because that's basically all they talked about, how graphs, if you don't label your graphs properly and a person is looking at the graph, they don't know what scale you're using. If your graph, there's like a high boom from bottom left to top right, they're going to think, wow, whatever product they're doing, it's working. Or, oh, if I invest in this company, oh, I'm going to get this much money like they are.
Right. You don't know what those numbers mean. They could just put, you know, an increase of 1 to 5.
Yeah, and from 1 to 5, to make it seem bigger, they could be like 0.2, 0.4, 0.6.
Right, right. But you really don't know what that means, if anything at all. So if you remember in our first podcast in chapter 1, we sort of discussed the examples that the author used, like the average salary of a Yale graduate from 1924, and we talked about how statistically biased those populations are, you know, with people not falsely reporting their income, or just people, you know, not reporting their income at all. So the people who are publishing that article could make a false assumption. But here, what we want to talk about, what I wanted to ask you, is stratified random samples. And I want you to ask, what are some of the advantages of that, and what are some of the disadvantages of that? And if you could quote an example, that would be fantastic.
Okay, so on page 19, there is a psychiatrist reported that practically everybody is neurotic. And aside from that, the fact that switches destroys the meaning in the word neurotic. Take a look at the man's sample. So his sample was basically of his patients.
Right.
He didn't sample anyone outside of his office. And, you know, this is going to, if he's saying basically everyone's neurotic, how can he determine that if he's only sampling or making a conclusion from the people that
he has his patients.
Yeah, his patients. So obviously there's going to be something wrong with the people that he's
seeing.
Yeah.
So he can't make an assumption about all people, because the people who aren't seeing them obviously don't need to go see him.
Right.
Okay.
What do we need to ask besides which kind of average is being used and why?
I think that's a great question, and a really good example that the author uses in the beginning of chapter 3 is a toothpaste company, Doakes Toothpaste, reports users having 23% fewer cavities when they use it. And this is these are independent results coming from an independent laboratory. And then you read on and you find out that Doakes does this very deceivingly, and they only use a small group of users, 12. And I think that's really important when you examine averages and percentages, like this one that says 23% less cavities when you use this toothpaste. They're only using a population of 12 people. It is not going to show any sort of change, any sort of trend, if you have 12 people. I think that's one of the biggest things. The population affects the outcome.
So explain why advertisers often rely on a very small sample to substantiate their claims.
Well, back to what I was just saying, Chatelise, about this toothpaste company. They're able to show a trend. This, in this specific example, it was 23% fewer aches or cavities when you use their toothpaste, but they only used a population of 12 people. And back to what I was saying, you can't, there's no real change when you only have 12 people, just like you can't make an assumption that heads, if you flip a coin 10 times and heads comes up 8 and tails come up 2 times, you can't say that there's an 80% chance that you will get heads when you flip a coin.
Right.
You need to flip it like 1,000 times to show any real trend, any real, you know, data.
But whenever we flip a coin, it's never going to be 50-50. You know, our math says that our, you know, our statistics, our data should be 50-50. But in reality, I feel like if you're going to flip a coin 100 times, maybe we need to find a range anywhere if it falls 5 below 50 or 5 above 50 for heads. So it'll be like 45 heads and 55 tails, or anywhere from 55 tails to 45 heads can also be around an even amount of numbers due to human error, I guess.
I think another thing that companies sort of do to substantiate their claims is that they'll take one distribution or one sample of something they did, like the 8 out of 10 heads when you flip a coin 10 times. And I think what that does is that they'll say, oh, let's use this one specific example because it reflects our product best. And they don't do any more runs. They just do it this one time. But no one is the wiser because they never tell you that. Okay, so my next question for you, Chevalise, is which kind of average would you give would you give me, for example, the best way to compare the performance of two classes that I taught for a required math course? Why?
So I would personally use mode and the mean. The reason why I would pick the mode and the mean is because when you're looking at the mode, you're going to see what test scores occurred the most. So if you have a student that had a 0 in one of the tests, maybe because he wasn't there, and then another student who got 100, you know, because she did everything right, she answered all the questions, and she was there in class, then, you know, you have a huge range, and there's a bunch of different numbers in between, but it's anywhere from 0 to 100, and when adding all of those numbers up, you're going to get your mean, and then you'll see your mode. And let's say it was a fairly easy exam, so you have a lot of students that are in the 80s and 100s range, you're going to have an outlier when graphing this because you have that 0 on your test score, and that's why I said those two.
I would disagree with you just on the mode part if we had to choose just one kind of average, because I would just use the arithmetical average because that allows you to see the average for class A and class B for all the test scores. And I think if it's not a fairly easy test, if it's just, you know, your standard statistics quiz, then you're going to have sort of like a bell curve. You're going to have most of the people falling in the middle around the same score, and then you're going to have an equal amount of people lower than that score and higher to that score. So I think that's the best way to display that kind of data.
Assuming that every student attended class, because,
yeah,
you know, there can be a lot of students who are missing that day, and your data would be completely different. So we have to, not only are we going to be recording, I mean, yeah, like testing the grades that these people have, we also have to see what other factors have played into getting that grade.
So moving on, my next question for you is, I believe this is in chapter 3 on page 45, and our author says, hardly anyone is exactly normal in any way. And he's talking about a group of children who learn to sit up at different ages. What do you take away from that?
So what I take away from that is that people are confusing normal with averages, and, you know, when you do that, you're making people feel like what they have isn't what it should be. So, for example, they were giving the example of a child being born and then eventually learning how to sit up. If the child learns how to sit up before the quote-unquote normal stage, the normal age, then, you know, they're really smart, they're going to be so successful. But then if your child learns how to sit up straight after the quote-unquote normal time frame, then they're either, you know, retarded or subnormal, and this is what it's saying on page 44. And then on page 45, it's saying that confusing normal with desirable makes it all the worse. Dr. Giselle simply stated some observed facts. It was the parents who were reading the book and articles concluded that a child who walks late by a day or a month must be inferior. So parents make these assumptions that their child is going to be sick, but if you're an author and you're going to give some facts and statistics, label your graphs, give more information, because I feel like anyone who just sees a graph that says, okay, everyone is doing this, this is normal, then everybody's going to conclude that there's something wrong with their child because they're not fitting in the normal range.
Yeah, I really agree with you on that, and I think another example of that quote that I mentioned in my question is, you know, you can't just say that if you flip a coin 100 times
right. And
you get more tails than heads or heads than tails, that coin is unfair. You're not going to see a trend, because very rarely will it come out 50-50 in those situations. So my next question is, how are some reported differences not real differences at all, and others, even though they can show to be real differences, should probably still be ignored? So I want to have you give me some examples of how both of those situations could arise.
The example provided on page 53, chapter 4, they're talking about Peter's IQ score compared to Linda's IQ score. Peter got a 98 and Linda got a 101. So when your IQ score is higher than 100, they're like, wow, this child is bright, they're intelligent, you know, they're going to make it far. When you're below, they're looking at Linda and Peter, and they're like, okay, well, he has a 98. But they're not really testing anything else other than what society thinks is right.
I think the counterexample to that, so, like, even if something can show a real difference, it should still be ignored. Using that example, 98 to 101, that's not really much of a difference at all. But they'll tell you that's a real difference, because 98 is below the average IQ, which is 100, and 101 is above. So it means that's just a way of saying you're below average and above average, no matter how marginal it is. So I think, you know, IQ tests are already not a good barometer of how intelligent a person is, because they don't test all the skills that you need. They don't test how creative somebody is, how passionate somebody is about anything, or how imaginative somebody is. So I think just saying, like, oh, I got an IQ of 101 or I got an IQ of 98 is not a fair way to say either I'm above average or I'm below average.
What do you think is deceiving about the graphs on page 61 and 62?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. On 61, you have a graph here showing a $2 billion increase over 1 year. And it's sort of unnecessary to have 0 through 18 listed on there if you only want to show 20 through 24, really. So when you look at this graph, $2 billion increase is great. That's huge for 1 year. But if you compare that to the graph on page 63, it looks like nothing. The numbers haven't changed in terms of the increase, but the way the graph is represented on page 63 makes it look much more outstanding. On page 63, rather than the y-axis increasing by $2 billion, as it does on 61, it increases by 0.2. So it starts at $20 billion and ends at $22 billion. And it looks like an almost... The steepness of this line is incredible. You know, it shows this stark increase in profit over this 1 year span, but it's really the same graph as on page 61. There's a lot of ways this happens in everyday life, like this article we were reading, on Gizmodo.com about misleading graphs, and there was one about Bush tax cuts. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure, but I'd rather talk about the same data and differences in the y-axis, but if you just look at the if Bush tax cut expire, it's 35%, and then in January 1st, 2013, it's going to be 39.6%. it's just a 4% difference, but the way you see the graphs is completely different. As well as if you scroll a little bit down and you go to the same data, different y-axis, it's the exact same data.
Right.
But the difference is that the y-axis are different. In the one on the left, it's at 3.14 and it goes all the way to 3.15.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one on the right, it goes from 0 to 3.50. And if you look at the graphs, they're
almost identical.
They're like, the data is identical, but for the second one, yeah, like you said, they're almost identical, but the one on the left is skewed. So it's the same data, but when you change the y-axis,
right,
visually, it looks like something else.
So a way that we often see graphs that mislead intentionally to show a real difference or to sort of exaggerate a piece of data, it's shown through things like global warming. So we have this sample of average temperatures by month from January to July in a town called New Haven in Connecticut. And there's this graph, and it shows a stark increase from January to July in terms of temperature in Fahrenheit. But what you could figure out, what you could deduce from just looking at the numbers in the graph, it's winter in January and February. So it would be normal that in a town like Connecticut, where it's colder because you're in the you're going closer towards the North Pole, you have a temperature that's below 30. While in March, you have one that's in the mid-30s, and then April, May, June, July, it starts to warm up because you're going into summer. It just makes sense. And what they try to do here is lie to you, saying that global warming is causing that increase in temperature when it's really just the changing of the season.
It's a dollar bill. And on the dollar bill, it's just cut up into different sections, and the military takes 27%, healthcare takes 22%, and it keeps going smaller. And this actually shows you, you know, how it's more broken down, but they don't tell you, you know, how many branches are in the military. They don't divide it by, like, Army, Navy, Marines, and then on and so forth. So they don't talk about the healthcare benefits that they receive in the military. So they need to break these statistics down a little bit more than just, like, generalizing big categories, because then there's a graph similar to it if you scroll down, and it shows you the graph. And then military is, I guess you'd say, 27% of the 100, but when you scroll down, they cut it into a pie chart, and on the pie chart they get 1/3 of the entire graph. So you have the numbers, but when they put it in the graph, they just make something that's more eye appealing, and they'll say, oh, the military takes 1/3 of every tax dollars, making it 33 cents rather than 27 cents.
I think it's obviously misleading that they use that dollar bill to show the federal budget. You know, it's a very poor way of showing, you know, graphical data through, you know, dividing a dollar bill into different sections when they could have easily done, you know, like a bar graph with how much money was spent in billions.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Today we'll be talking about chapters 9 all the way to the ending. Specifically, we're going to start off with a quote we found on page 110 and 111.
The sort of example I wanted to cite in the beginning of this podcast was the way companies are able to use percentages of numbers to lie about, you know, certain figures that they make up. So they'll say that there's a 50% pay cut on a worker's $100 wage. That would obviously bring it down to $50. But if they say there's a 50% pay cut that's restored, what they're doing is not giving back the 50% that was taken from the worker's pay cut, but rather taking 50% of 50, which is 25, and adding it to the $50 paycheck, making that 75.
That's interesting, because all throughout the book we've been learning about how to use our different averages, and sometimes statistics fools people, assuming that you know, with this specific example, you're thinking, okay, well, they're bringing up the budget by 25%. You think you're going to get your money back. Either ways, you're losing a fourth of your money if you're looking at the subtraction-wise rather than the percentage-wise. And I feel like that's how big companies trick you. A lot of people don't realize it because there are small, sudden changes. But you have to know the differences in what you're actually seeing to be able to determine whether or not it's beneficial for you.
I think another technique that a lot of, you know, indexes use and that they use to persuade a lot of the people who read what they list is to take prices and manipulate the increase or decrease in that price to favor, you know, one audience over another. So on page 118, the author is talking about the price of bread being five cents a loaf 1 year and the price of a quart of milk being 20 cents. And then the next, the price of a quart of milk went down to 10 cents, which is a 50% decrease. And then the price of a loaf of bread went up to 10 cents, which is a 100% increase. And they can use those statistics, that 50% and 100%, to, you know, manipulate those numbers, even though it's the same thing.
What I find interesting as well from the information that you just provided is that they don't talk about minimum wage going up, so therefore the prices of food went up or things like that, because now, you know, you can find a loaf of bread for $2.99. Some can be anywhere. I'd say you could find a loaf of bread anywhere from $2 to
$4. Yeah.
And so, and a gallon of milk from anywhere from like $4 to $5.50-ish. So it's more so they don't really specify whether or not there is an increase in pay or anything. They just say milk went up. But they're not saying milk went up because this happened. Maybe, you know, there's a lack of cows and a farm in, I don't know, west of the United States. And so, you know, the prices of milk go up because there's lacks of cows, I guess. So that's another factor. They don't talk, I guess, about the third party factors.
Yeah. But I think what is interesting is that they can use those percentages, those increases and decreases in prices of items, to make people upset about that and to make it seem like that's a bad thing. But in reality, the sum of those two totals is 5 cents cheaper than it was last year. The 10 cents for the loaf of bread and the 10 cents for the quart of milk.
Which takes us to a quote on page 128 that says, "Sometimes it is percentages that are given and raw figures that are missing, and this can be deceptive too." Back to what you were saying, they're using percentages to substitute money or actual, like, the number in itself.
Another quote that I wanted to mention to wrap this all up is on page 131, and it says, "When assaying a statistic, watch out for a switch somewhere between the raw figure and the conclusion. One thing is all too often reported as another." And I think you had a really interesting point that you made with that. Would you like to tell me what that is?
In general, you have to be very aware of what your averages are, your mean, your medial, your median, and mode of overall statistics. And I guess now you also have to look at percentages when looking at all of that data, because you can't just look at one side of the story and assume everything is going to fall into that picture. And I think that really wraps up our entire statistics class. And I feel like this book overall wraps up a lot of the things that we learn in statistics, because, you know, we were taught what to do at first. And from what we were taught, we had to make our own conclusions and then, you know, assume that this is the right thing because this is our average. And then we took this survey saying, after we did that, are we extremely confident about our answers? And you know me, I would say, yeah, 9. I gave myself a 9 saying I'm completely confident that my answer is right. And you know what? Now if I would take that survey again and answer all of the questions that were on there, I'd probably give myself a 3, because now I know that I have to observe the mean, the median and the mode in order to draw a conclusion.
The correct way.
Yeah.
And with greater accuracy. And
right.
I think what we're doing now in statistics with the chi-squared and things like that, and whether you accept or reject the null hypothesis, is really relates back to this quote.
Right.
Thank you for staying with us for our podcast, and we'll see you again next time.
See you.